we're holding on Chof Omid Beis, 15 lines from the bottom. We learned yesterday about how Shlomo sat on the Vayeshev Shlomo al Kisei Hashem. The pasuk says Shlomo sat on the throne of Hashem, and in particular that, and we learned from that that since it says Ki Yod al Kisei Kom Milchama Hashem Ba'Amalek, means there first has to be a Jewish king sitting on the throne of Hashem, meaning the throne that's dedicated to Hashem, and then after that comes time for the war with Amalek. So now the Gemara is going to bring another drasha having to do with that pasuk about Vayeshev Shlomo al Kisei Hashem. So 15 lines from the bottom of Chof Amud Beis. The Gemara says, Amud Shlokish, V'tchila Molech Shlomo al Ha'yoinim. Originally, Shlomo ruled even over the upper beings, the Malachim and the Shadim and whatnot. Shenema, as the pasuk says, Vayeshev Shlomo al Kisei Hashem, Shlomo sat on the throne of Hashem. That means, in other words, he had rulership in a somewhat similar way to Hashem's, ruling over everything in the higher worlds and the lower worlds. All of a sudden, Malach al Tachtonim, later on, as time went by, in particular after, Rashi says, after he married the various Goyish women that he wasn't supposed to marry. Now, okay, the Rambam says he was Megayer then, but still, he shouldn't have done it, and it caused all kinds of problems. So therefore, after that, he ruled over Malach al Tachtonim. Then he ruled only over the lower beings, only on earth. As the pasuk says, Kihu roide b'chol Abraham Nahar mitifsach vad Aza. He ruled over this entire side of the river from Tifsach till Aza, which are places on earth. So it wasn't like before where he was ruling over the upper beings as well. What it means to rule over them? Well, we know that we have the story in Gittin how he controlled even the Shadim. Rabbi Yaakov Emden points out it means also that he controlled the Sorim, the Ruchnisikah, the Malachim that are the source of Hashpa for the other nations, so he ruled over them as well, and that way he's able to rule over those nations through them. And now it's just a regular terrestrial kingship without any Malachim or Shadim or everything. So the Gemara, by the way, mentions when we say that he ruled from Tifsach till Aza. Now that's not the whole world. So what does that mean? So Rav and Shmuel argue what the pasuk means. Chad Omer Tifsach b'sofa olam v'Aza b'sofa olam. One says that Tifsach and Aza are at opposite ends of the world. So therefore, so it means that he ruled all the way from one end of the world to the other. The other one says that Tifsach and Aza were actually right next to each other. So then what's the greatness of ruling over the two of them? Just as easily as he ruled over Tifsach and Aza, because they're adjacent cities and it's easy to rule over the both of them, that's how easily he ruled over the entire world. So one point Marsha makes the point, therefore, so then why mention these two cities? Because these two cities were well known as parts of his kingship. There is actually an interesting explanation. Since the world is round, then both opinions can be true. He ruled over Tifsach and Aza, one right next to the other. Well, when you go directly from one to the other, then you're going, then you just have that. And if you go in the other direction from one of them, then you have to circumnavigate the whole world to get to the other one. And therefore you can say that between the two of them, they encompass the entire world. Okay. So the Gemara continues. So far what we have is two stages of Shlomo's kingship. First he ruled even over the Elyonim, and now he rules only over the Tachtonim. So the Gemara continues. Then there was still a later stage when he's ruling only over the Jewish people. Shenemar, as we find a pasuk where he says about himself in Kehelas, Ani Kehelas Haisi Melech al Yisrael, the Gemara. I Kehelas, which is another name for Shlomo, was king over Yisrael in Yerushalayim. It says so as I was king only over Yisrael and not the other nations. Then there came even a further stage when he's ruling only over the city of Yerushalayim. Shenemar, as you have a few psukim earlier, Divrei Kehelas ben David Melech b'Yerushalayim, and he describes himself as just a king in Yerushalayim, implying not even over the rest of the Jewish people. Now the psukim are out of order. Maharsha says, fine. Sometimes you find that. But now, the big question is, what does this mean? I mean, Ben Yehoyada points out that it certainly doesn't mean that the other Shvatim rebelled against him. We don't find any such thing anywhere in the Psukim. So what it means is, in other words, that they didn't give him the full respect of a king anymore. So originally, originally they're giving him that full respect everywhere in the world, and then progressively, as things got worse and worse, as far as his as far as his wives, and as far as the other problems that were being caused by them, so then you have less and less respect that was given to him in different places in the world. But obviously he still ruled over them, but nevertheless they're still not giving him the same full respect that they did before. And then Ben Yehoyada goes on to explain that also what it means is, for example, it used to be that all the kings from all over, everyone would come to Shloimeh to hear his Chochma. Then eventually they stopped doing that, and only people from Eretz Yisrael are coming, and then only people from Yerushalayim and so forth. So it doesn't mean, as far as giving him the respect, it means coming to hear his tremendous Chochma, where he was Chacham Mikol Adam, after all. So that progressively got less and less. Continues the Gemara. All of a sudden, by Malach Ela Mitosei, there came a point when he ruled only over his own bed. As we have the pasuk, behold the bed of Shloimeh, which suggests that's the only thing that belongs to Shloimeh at this point, where he's still fully Shloimeh, is his bed. So again, according to the first explanation, it means that everyone else, is even outside his bedroom, is not really showing him the proper respect anymore. And according to the second explanation, it means like only his immediate close people are still eager to hear his chachma, and everybody else not so much. All of a sudden, then there eventually came a stage when Ashvedai kicked him off the throne, as you have the whole story in Gittin. Loi malach elal makla. He ruled over him only over his stick, only his walking stick. Shenemar, as you find the pasuk, Shloimeh says on himself in Kehelas, v'zeho yechelki mikol amoli, this was my portion from all my toil, from all my hard work. This always means something that you can point to. Marev etzvay v'emezeh. So it means that all he had left was one thing, which is all he has left is one thing, which is his stick. So again, it doesn't mean necessarily that. So now at this point, when he's off the throne, then yeah, it means more literally that he's only ruling. He doesn't have any kingship anymore because Ashmedai temporarily took it over.
But all this is happening. He sees slowly that he was at one point, and things are going lower and lower. He didn't question, ask Hashem, is something wrong? What am I doing? Am I doing something wrong? To be able to fix
whether
the
he asked Hashem, I don't know. But did he take the lesson from it? Evidently not. I mean, people are very good at rationalizing what they're doing, right? The Gemara is going to explain later on that Shloimeh was over on the three mitzvahs of a king, not to have too many wives or horses or gold and silver. But he figured, as the Gemara is going to say on later, on the I revelai also, I will be able to have many wives, and my heart won't turn away from Hashem and the various other things. So yeah, and the person unfortunately can rationalize to themselves what he was thinking as he was going through all of this. We don't know. I don't think it says, but yeah. And now in retrospect, he's mentioning it in Kehelas. I mean, say for Kehelas in particular, where you have a few of these psukim are from. The Medrash has different opinions in what order he wrote his Sforim. One opinion is that he wrote Kehelas at the end of his life. So in that case, he has now a chance to look back on what he did and to realize how badly things had gone. Yeah. So the Gemara says, Rav and Shmuel. So Rav and Shmuel actually have an argument. What is it that he had left at this point after Ashmedai had kicked him off the throne? Chad om a makloi v'chad om a gundoi. One says all he had left was a stick. And the other one says all he has left is gundoi, which Rashi says, and it means his talus. Then Rashi brings from Rav Hai Goyen that the word is not gundoi, but rather makedoi, which means an earthenware cup that you drink out of. So all he had left was that. There's an interesting vote from the Vilna Goyen that says that those two things hint at really, what does he have left after everything? He doesn't have his wealth, he doesn't have his power. What he does have is his schosim. We know that Shloimeh, in particular, made the takonis of Erevin and Atilus Yadayim. Those are among the Sheva Mitzvahs Zabonim. So now he has left his stick representing Erevin, in the sense that you can carry a stick now in places where you otherwise wouldn't have been able to, and the Erevin themselves are made out of poles and sticks and whatnot, and the cup, according to the second explanation of Rashi, that it means a cup representing the Tilos Yadayim. There's also a vote that, so what does it mean? He's a king. How does a person, a king over his stick or over his cup, means that even then, Shloimeh felt himself as a king, and he still behaved as a king should, even though all he has left is these personal items of his. Anyway, so there was a point when Shloimeh only had that. Now, Hodor or Loi Hodor, the question is, did Shlomo ever return to his kingship or not? Rav and Shmuel, so Rav and Shmuel argue, Chad Omer Hodor, Chad Omer Loi Hodor, one says he returned, and the other one says he didn't. Manda Omer Loi Hodor, the one who says he didn't return, means he holds that the order was Melech Vehedya. So Shlomo started out as a king, and eventually became a Hedya to commoner. Umanda Omar Hodor, the one who says he did return to the throne, holds Melech Vehedya to Melech. He holds that there was a state. He was started out as a king. Then there was a stage when he was a Hedya. And then there was a stage again where he's a Melech again. So now, on the face of it, the Gemara is saying that according to one opinion, he passed away as a commoner, that he never became a king again. Marshal has a great difficulty with that. I mean, the fact is, the Pesukim make it very clear, he ruled for 40 years and he passed away as a king, so there's no question that he was a king at the end of his life. So what do you mean, Melech Vehedya? So Marshal says that maybe the opinion, Melech Vehedya means, in other words, that his kingship was never the same as it was before. Sure, he went back to being a king, but not anywhere near the high level where it was before, that he's ruling Al HaYonim and so forth. And then the opinion, Melech Vehedya or Melech, would say that there was a time in between where he was a complete Hedyet, yeah, where he was kicked off the throne, but eventually he regained his full kingship in all of its senses. That's Marshal. And then different other Mephoshim talk about different possibilities in this as well, about whether it means that he actually was restored to it, in other words. So Ben Yehoyada says, in other words, it doesn't literally mean that he died not a king. According to the first opinion, just means that he didn't have his great chokhmah and he didn't have everything that he had before. It was on a lesser level than before, relative to which, in other words, the Melech Vehedyet would mean, in other words, there was a period in his kingship where he's a king, but he's also a Hedyet at the same time, meaning he's not as great of a king as he was before, as opposed to Melech Vehedyet or Melech would mean there was a time when he was a Melech Vehedyet, but then he went back to being a complete king with all of the trappings of it. Okay. Next, the Mishnah had said, Poritz Lassus Loi Derech, that a king can break through people's gates and then whatever to make for himself a road. As we learned yesterday, Rashi holds that this would mean even, for example, to go to his own properties. If there's somebody else's field in the way, then he can blaze a path through. According to the Rambam, it means specifically when he needs a path for his army to go through. Anyway, the Mishnah had then gone on to say that when it comes to fighting a war and they capture spoils, the king gets half because they bring all the spoils in front of the king. He gets half, and everybody else divides the other half between themselves. So the Gemara says, Tanan Abanan, we learn in a Braisa, Oitzris Melochim Mamelach, the king's treasuries, if they capture a foreign king's treasury in a war, Mamelach, then that goes straight to the king. Ushor Biza Shabozin, the rest of the spoils that they capture, Mechtzel Melech or Mechtzel Am, half of it goes to the king and half to the people. So, Omalei Abayelar of Dimi, Va'amilolar of Acha, Bishlema Oitzris Melochim LaMelech. I understand why the king's treasuries go to the king. Ulcha de Milsa, it's a normal thing. These were in a king's treasury before, so it's only right that now this wealth should go to a king's treasury. Where do we know what it said in the Mishnah and in the Braisa that the rest of the spoils go half to the king and half to the rest of the people? So the answer is Yechtiv, because you have like this. When Shlomo was anointed, the Pasuk says in Divrei Hayamim, Vayim Shechula Hashem Menogid Olot Tzadik. The Pasuk says they anointed Shlomo in front of Hashem as the Nogid, which is another word for a king, Olot Tzadik, and then they anointed Tzadik as well. So in the simple sense, it means, in other words, that they anointed Shlomo and Tzadik was present at the time. Or it means that they anointed Shlomo and then at the same time they anointed Tzadik as the new Kohen Gadol. But whatever, the point is, Makish Nogid Lot Tzadik. The point is, the Pasuk is making a comparison between the Nogid, the king, and Tzadik, who was the Kohen Gadol. Ma Tzadik Mechtzaloi or Mechtzal Echav. Now Tzadik, being the Kohen Gadol, as the Gemara is going to explain in a second, that when things are divided up between the Kohen Gadol and the other Kohenim, the Kohen Gadol gets half, at Nogid Mechtzaloi or Mechtzal Echav, the same way the Nogid, the king, gets half, and everybody else gets the other half. We learned, by the way, in Bava Basra, in a similar vein, if a person says that I'm giving my nechassim to Ploini, to Ploini and to the children of Ploini, or something like that, then we said that Ploini gets half, and the children of Ploini gets half, because by singling him out, it means that he meant for him to get half, similar to this. So, with Sadek Gufrim in Olan, by Sadek himself, by the Kohen Gadol, where do we see that he gets half? So the Tanya, Rebbe Omer, Vahoysel Aaron Levana, when the Pasuk says about the Lechem upon him being distributed among the Kohenim, it should be for Aaron and his sons. That means by singling out Aaron, it means Mechsel Aaron and Mechsel Levana, half goes to Aaron as Kohen Gadol, and half goes to his sons who are the Kohenim at Yotim. So in the same way, in a later generation, Sadek, when he was the Kohen Gadol, would get half the lechem upon him, and the rest of the kohenim would get the other half. So then by the hekesh, that tells us the same is true of the king when they're dividing up the spoils. So again, anything that was in the foreign king's treasury goes straight to the king. That there's no division of, because there it's logical. It was in a king's treasury before. It goes to a Jewish king now. The rest is half and half. Now, we are going to learn later on that a king is not allowed to have, we're going to learn on Omid Beis, a king is not allowed to have too much gold and silver. So how does that fit with over here, if he's going to have, if he's going to be getting all these treasuries from foreign kings and whatever, he's going to have an awful lot of gold and silver. There is actually an explanation that maybe when the Torah asks him to have too much gold and silver is maybe only when he raises taxes or whatever and he has too much of that. But if it's that he gets it, for example, by spoils of war, maybe there's nothing wrong with it. On the other hand, when the Rambam brings these halachas, he doesn't draw any such distinction, and therefore, according to the Rambam, you might have to say that, fine, he gets these things, and they go to the king's treasury, but afterwards, he's expected to keep only what he needs for his expenses, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, on Omid Beis, and then the rest of it, he has to give to the Beis Mikdash, or give out to the people, or whatever. So the Gemara goes, okay, so say, the Mishnah says, Lord, now we know the king has three special mitzvahs, and the first one of them is not to have too many wives. Lo yabela noshin. So lo yabela noshin, he's not allowed to have too many wives, so what is the maximum that he can have? Ela shmoina esrei. The maximum he can have is 18, as the Gemara is going to learn out from Pesukim. Rabbi Yehuda omer mar behuloi uvavad shaloi yom mesiris es libei. Rabbi Yehuda says he can have as many as he wants. He can have even more than 18 as long as they don't turn his heart away from Hashem. So in other words, since the pasuk says lo yarva lo noshim v'lo yosu levava, he should not have many wives and his heart should not turn away from Hashem. So Rabbi Yehuda understands that that's a limitation. It means that he shouldn't have too many wives because those wives will turn his heart away from Hashem, implying that if they're not going to, if they're all tzidkaniyus, then he can have more. Reb Shimon says, no, I feel achas a mesira es libay, harez a lo yisena. No, if there's even one wife among his ones who's going to turn him away from Hashem and get him into Avodah Zarah or other things like that, he would be also to marry her. So, imkein loma nemela, yagol enoshim. So what does it mean? He can't have for himself many wives. Da'afilu ka'avigayel means even if they're all tzidkoniyus, like Abigail, who was a neviyah, she's one of the seven neviyahs, then even then there's a limitation. So now, does it actually mean, are there two or three opinions in the Mishnah over here? There are different opinions about that. One way of looking at it is the Tanakhama is saying, by default, 18. If you don't know about them, one way, Tanakhama would be saying that would be saying that you can't have 18 because Mesiras es Levavai. Because they're going to take his heart away from Hashem. But implying, in other words, that then Rabbi Yehuda would be saying so the Tanakhama would be saying, in other words, that if you don't know one way or the other about these women, then you can marry a maximum of 18. Rabbi Yehuda is saying if they're all tzidkaniyus, there could be more, and Rabbi Shimon is saying that not the limit is 18, no matter what. So there may be two or three opinions in the Mishnah. Sometimes you find like that a Tanakhama will say a generic statement, and then later Tanoim will argue about that. So in other words, there is the Rosh and the Rabbeinu Yonah and others explain or say that maybe the Tanakhama is holding that you can have up to 18, whether Mesiris es Levavai or not. The Tanakhama may hold, even if among the 18, there are some who are not so good and they may turn his heart away from Hashem, the Tanakhama might say that's fine and he could still marry them. Whereas Rabbi Shimon would be saying absolutely not. If Mesiris es Levavai, you can never marry such a person. And according to Rabbi Yehuda, if they're all tzidkoniyus, and can go even beyond 18. So there may be three opinions in the Mishnah, or there may be only the Tanakhama is making a generic statement, and Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon are explaining it. Okay. So the Gemara says, "Lememre de Rehuda Dorish Taima Dekra, Reb Shimon Le Dorish Taima Dekra." So you're telling me it comes out that Reb Yehuda is darshaning the reason of the pasuk. He's saying because the pasuk is insisting that his wives not turn his heart away from Hashem, therefore if they're all tzidkonius, then therefore that reason doesn't apply and he can go beyond 18. And Reb Shimon says, "No, absolutely not. You can never go beyond 18." So Reb Shimon is not paying attention to the reason behind the mitzvah. The problem with that is we find that Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon hold respectively exactly the opposite. The Tanya, you have like this. The Torah tells us, voice sachvo beged almona. You're not allowed to take an almona's clothing as a mashkan. Now, what does this mean? So Bryce says, Almona benshi yaniya benshi yashira. When an almona, whether she's poor or rich, now if she's poor, you're gonna have to return her the mashkan every day, as we learned back in Bava Metzia. A poor person, for example, you take their day clothing, you have to return it to them every morning so they can use it to go to work. If it's bed clothes, then you have to return it to them every night so they have what to sleep in. So with this almana, whether she's poor or rich, ain't mashkin. You can't take a mashkin from her. Shenemar lo sach lo beged almana, because the pasuk says don't take a mashkin of clothing, the clothing of an almana. Period. Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. Reb Shimon says no. Ashiram a mashkin noisa. Ani ain't a mashkin noisa. No. Reb Shimon says if she's rich, then you can take the mashkin from her. If she's poor, then you can't. Because because after all, if she's poor, you're going to have to constantly be returning the mashkin. You're going to cause her to get a bad reputation among her neighbors. What's this guy coming and visiting her every day or every night or even both, depending what kind of mashkin it was? And then people are going to start suspecting that something wrong is going on over here. But if she's rich, then she has many. Items, she has many outfits of clothing and many sets of bed clothes and whatever, and you don't have to return it to her on a daily basis. So then Reb Shimon says there's no problem. So you see, so we explain when we learn in that in Bava Metzia, my comma, what does that mean? How does returning it to her cause her a bad reputation? Once you took the mashkin, then you have to return it to her every day or every night, as the case may be. And you're giving her a bad reputation coming and going all the time. Alma, Rabbi Yehuda loy dorish taima dekra, Rabbi Shimon dorish taima dekra. So it comes out the other way around. Rabbi Yehuda is saying, never mind what reasoning behind the mitzvah you might find. We don't darshan that when it comes as far as establishing the parameters of halacha. The Torah says l'sachol begad almana. Period. There's no exceptions to that. Whereas Rabbi Shimon is dorish taima dekra. He's looking into why would the Torah ask you to take a mashkin from an almana? It must be because such and such, and therefore he uses that to deduce the parameters of the halacha. So there we see Rabbi Shimon does that and Rabbi Yehuda doesn't, whereas here in the Mishnah, it's the other way around. Rabbi Yehuda is Dorish Taima Dekra. He's saying that only because there's a problem, Mesiras Islibai, implying that if all of them are Tzidkonius, then there's no problem marrying more than 18. And Rabbi Shimon is saying the other way around. So they're contradicting themselves. So the answer is, Ba'alma Rabbi Yehuda lo darsh taima dekra. No, usually Rabbi Yehuda does not darsh in taima dekra. He says, never mind, whether the Torah says a reason for a mitzvah or not, we can't use that to limit what cases the mitzvah applies to. He says, usually that's the case because the Torah doesn't specify the reason. V'shayni hocha, the mefarash taima dekra. Here, actually, the Torah does take the trouble to spell out the reason. Ma tam lo yarba lo noshim, why is he not allowed to have a lot of wives? Mishum de lo yosu levare, because we don't want his heart to turn away from Hashem. So therefore, so Rabbi Yehuda says, the Torah itself is implying, unlike by the Almana, where the Torah doesn't specify the reason behind the mitzvah, here it does. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda says, that obviously the Torah is implying, where the reason doesn't apply, then the mitzvah doesn't apply. Well then, if they're all tzidkonius, and they're not going to be mesiras eslibo, they're not going to be removing his heart from focus on Hashem, then gezunt ahet, let him marry more. Rabbi Shimon Amalach, Rabbi Shimon says, on the contrary, Mechti ba'alma darshin in time of the Krah. Let's consider. Usually we darshin the reason behind the mitzvah. So usually, even if the Torah doesn't tell us a reason, we can deduce the reason ourselves and then use that to determine when the mitzvah applies and when not. So in this case, the Torah should have just said he should not have many wives and not say anything. And we would understand on our own. One second. That why shouldn't he have many? Because it would cause him to turn away. Therefore, Reb Shimon says here where the Torah gives the reason, it's not that the mitzvah doesn't apply when the reason doesn't apply. Just the opposite. The Torah is telling us two considerations. Number one, don't have many wives b'chol. And number two, by mentioning the reason, lo yosir, afilo achas ha-masira es-libar, ha-reza lo yisana, because it means even any one individual wife who's going to turn away his heart from Hashem, he's not allowed to marry. Elamani makayim lo yarba, da'afilo kavigayel, and then the lo yarba means that he can't marry even more than 18, he can't ever marry more than 18, even if all of them are tzidkonius. So they're being consistent with their usual opinions elsewhere about whether Darshin and Taima Dikra. Now, by the way, both Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon agree, sure, by all means, we can look for reasons behind the mitzvahs. There are Sfarim that are full of that. The Rambam and Mor Nebuchim brings reasons behind a lot of mitzvahs. The Sefer HaChinuch tries to bring a reason behind every mitzvah as much as possible. Everybody agrees you can do that. The question is whether you can use that to determine when does the mitzvah apply and when does it not. So that Rabbi Shimon holds generally you can do, and Rabbi Yehuda holds generally you cannot. And again, here, because the pasuk itself spells out the reason, then it comes out the other way around. Fine. The Gemara says, "Hani Shmoina Esrei Minolan." Where do we see? Where do we get this number of 18 from? So it's like this. Let's look at David's wives. It says when David was ruling in Hebron, as we talked about yesterday, David was king over Yehuda only, with his capital in Hebron for 7.5 years, and then the rest of the Shvatim accepted him as king, and he moved his capital to Yerushalayim and continued ruling there for 33 years. So meanwhile, while he was in Hebron, the pasuk says he had children. And they were as follows. Vayhi b'chorei Amnon l'achinoyim ha-Yisraelis. His eldest son was Amnon, born to Achinoyim from Israel. We're going to talk about Amnon soon. U'mishnehu Chilov l'Avigayel eshes novel ha-Kaimali. The second one after him was Chilov, who was born to Avigayel, who had formerly been the wife of novel ha-Kaimali. So you have the whole story in Shmuel Aleph, where novel was a Rosha, and he was a stingy guy, and he didn't want to give David food, and eventually he died, and David married his widow, Avigayel, who was a tzaddik. So he had a second son with her. Vashlishi Avshalom ben Macha. The third is Avshalom ben Macha, who we'll talk about Macha soon. Varevi Adonia ben Chagis. The fourth one was Adonia ben Chagis, who also we're going to talk about more on Omid Beis. Vachamishi Shvatya ben Avital. The fifth one is Shvatya from his wife Avital. So each one of them, in other words, we're saying each one of them gave birth to one son while he was in Hebron. So the fifth one is Shvatya ben Avital. The Gemara elsewhere mentions that the family of Rebbe was descended from that son. Vashishi Yisraam la'egla eshes David. The sixth one is Yisraam, who was born to Egla, the wife of David. We're going to talk about later who Egla is. So in short, so far, Ela Yuldul David and Hebron, these were the ones who were born to David and Hebron. So in short, David had six wives at this point, and he had six children, one child from each wife. Now let's fast forward years later. He's in Yerushalayim, and you have the whole story of Bathsheba. The Ka'amalei Novi, so now the Novi Nosson comes to him to criticize him and tell him off for what he did in taking Bathsheba, and he says, you think you don't have enough wives? V'imma'ot, if you think you have too little, v'osifa l'cha kohena v'chahena, then I can add to you like them and like them. Well, so far he had six. Kohena shis, right, so he has so far six. Kohena would mean another six. V'chohena shis, and like them would mean another six. So there you go. So the havelahu t'mani shrei. So therefore, that gets you up to 18. Now, to be sure, by this point, the earlier psukim say that after David made his capital in Yerushalayim, it says he married more wives than Pilagshim. So on the face of it, he has more than six at this point. But one explanation is that pasuk is just describing eventually, during his 30-odd years of kingship in Yerushalayim, eventually he married other wives in Pelagshim. But at the time when he marries Bathsheba, he may indeed have still only had the original six. And therefore, the Navi is telling him that now, what do you think? You need so many more? Then fine, you could have three times as many as you have now without being over, but not going beyond that.
So there's different possibilities. In other words, that now, in fact, the Orach HaNer adds also that David's wives are certainly tzidkonius. But fine, and according to Rabbi Yehuda, you could go beyond 18 if they're tzidkonius. But fine, he says this pasuk is an asmachta for the number 18. But in any case, the point is that therefore, of course, Bathsheba herself is the seventh wife now. But that's the point. The Navi is telling him, you married her, you didn't really do the right thing, so you can't say that Kohena V'chayna would be including her, and say 21, it means the six that you had so far, then you could have twice as many.
Who's speaking here about now David or Shlomo Melech?
We're talking about David over here. We're talking about David. Bathsheba was Shlomo's mother.
Right, okay.
Okay, Maske for Ravina. So Ravina asks on that, why are you understanding it that way? Emo Kahena Tauti Srei. Maybe say the first Kahena means you can double the number you have now, which would bring you up to 12. V'Kahena Esrim Arba. And then V'Kahena would be double that amount. Namely, you'd be up to 24. So how do you know it means only 18? And in fact, the Gemara says, Tani Nami Hochi. In fact, there is a braisa to that effect when it says, Lo Yabba Lo Noshim Yosim Esrim V'Arba. There is, in fact, a pasuk that says, there is, in fact, a braisa that says that lo yabra lo noshim can be understood to mean up to 24. And the Gemara, by the way, points out, lamanda dorish vova boi moshmoina havu. As a matter of fact, also, another way of looking at it, there is a machloikas in various places in Shas, whether we can add a, whether we can use a vov to darshan something additional on top of what we had before. If we say that, then the vov of vichohena would add more, and then we would be up to 48. Because we would say, it starts out with 6. Kohena would mean to double that, would mean 12. Vih would mean to double that again and get to 24. And Kahena would mean as many as that, which would be 48. And indeed, Tanya Nami Hochi, in fact, there is a braisa, Lo Yavel Enoshim Yosim Aboy Mishmoina. There is a braisa that says that he could have as many as 48. Well, the Tani Didan Mai Taime, what about Ortana? Why Taka doesn't he learn like any of those ways? Fine, the Vav, okay, not Ortanoim, Daushin of Vav, but why Taka does he not learn like Ravina said that Kahena would mean to double, and Kahena would mean to double again, and you'd end up with 24? And the answer is Amar of Kahana, Makish Kohena Basra la Kahena Kama, because he holds the hekish between the first and the second Kohenas. Ma Kohena Kama Shis, the first one necessarily means 6, because you have no basis to add more than that. He starts out with 6. A Kohena Basra Shis, the same way the second Kohena also has to refer to 6. So therefore, so it is 6, 6, and 6, which is 18, and not any more than that. Okay. So fine. So far we mentioned David's first 6 wives. Now, we learned a couple of days ago all about the story with Michal and Shol, or all about the story of Michal Bas Shol, and she's missing from the above list. David married her long before he became king, in fact, and he was and they were still together in Chevron. So you have to ask, Vaho Havoi Michal. So don't you have also Michal? So he has more than 6 at that point. You have the 6 that are mentioned in the Psukim that we quoted earlier, and then we know he was also married to Michal. So doesn't that mean that already at that point he has more than 6? Although actually, Maoshar explains that the point of the question is not so much that. The question is rather, the question is actually, the pasuk is mentioning the names of the wives he had. Well, what happened to Michal? Why is she missing from that list? The answer is, Amar Rav Eglozu Michal, the 6th one on the list, when it says that he had a son named Yisra'am from his wife Egla, Egla actually refers to Michal. The Lama Nikoshma Egla, why is she called Egla, which literally means a calf, Shechaviva Olav Ke'egla, because she was as precious and as dear to him as a calf. In other words, you sometimes use animal nicknames as to talk about how dear and beloved someone is to you. So it means, in other words, that she was particularly beloved to him. The pasuk actually makes a point that they loved it. The pasuk makes a point, which is a bit unusual when you're talking about husbands and wives in Tanakh, that they loved each other. So she was particularly dear to him, and therefore in this pasuk she's nicknamed Egla. And we see that the word Egla can be used of a wife. Shenemar, And we find by Shimshon, where he says, Lule harashna ve'eglossi, if you hadn't plowed with my calf. Meaning, you have the story over there with, Shimshon, where, right after he got married, he married a plishti girl, he was Magaya her, whatever, but, anyway, then he sorts up with the plishtim over there, he tells them a riddle, and he says, if you answer me, then if you can figure out the answer to the riddle within the 7 days of the Sheva Brachas, then I'm gonna have to give you a whole bunch of suits and then whatnot, and if not, then each of you are going to give me one, and they can't figure out the riddle, and eventually they pressure Shimshon's wife into telling it to them. So Shimshon tells them, Lule charashtem be'eglossi, if you hadn't plowed with my calf, then you wouldn't have figured out my riddle. So again, we see that he uses a calf as a nickname for a dear beloved wife. So the same way Eglo over here means Michal. Okay, well, the question is, did Michal in fact have children? You have later on, the pasuk says, well, Michal Bashol Hoyolo Volod Ad Yom Moisa. Michal Bashol did not have any children until she passed away, until the day that she died. So it sounds like she was childless. Omer of Chista, fine. It means Ad Yom Moisa Hoyolo B'Yom Moisa Hoyolo. Fine. It means she didn't have children throughout her life, but then she had children. She had a child on the day she died. She died in childbirth, in other words. But the Gemara says, really, that doesn't work. Mechti bonim hecha kachoshev lahu, because the psukim that we quoted earlier, when they list David's first six children, his first six sons, where were they all born? It says in Hebron. Whereas the whole story with Michal, which finishes off with the part that she had no child, took place in Yerushalayim. So you have like this, the psukim describe, after David came and set up Yerushalayim as his capital, that one of the next things he does is to bring the Oren to Yerushalayim. Up until that point, the Oren had been for 20 years in the city of Kiryas Yorim. Now he wants to bring it to Yerushalayim. We have it as after, we have the story as after the Parshas Shemini. So he tries to bring it up the first time. He makes a mistake of bringing it on a wagon. Uzzah touches the Oren because he thinks it's about to fall and he's killed. And David stops the whole thing and brings the Oren to the house of Obed Edom Agiti, who was a Levi. Obed Edom takes care of it for 3 months and he has tremendous brachas. So then David realizes that it's time to bring the Oren to Yerushalayim after all. As long as we're careful with the covered of it, he has the Levium carry it like it's supposed to be, and they bring it to Yerushalayim with a tremendous procession. And the psukim describe over there, David is leaping and dancing and then in front of the Oren and in tremendous simcha, and the pasuk says, she was looking out the window, watching. She saw David leaping and dancing in front of Hashem. And she mocked him in her heart. In her heart, she thought that it's not dignified for a king to act that way. And later on, when David comes home, the psukim describe how she tells him off for it. And David explains to her that, no, my covet doesn't mean anything in face of the covet of Hashem. And the pasuk continues, and then the pasuk continues with that point about that she had no children, and there's a connection. The Omer of Yehudavi, Tamer of Yosef, Shaklasa Michal Lamitaypusa, means that Michal got her punishment, by that, because she mocked David for dancing in front of the Oren, in front of the covet of Hashem, therefore she was childless and she didn't have any children. So we see that, and then it says, Adio Mosa till the day she died. So you're going to say she had a child on the day she died, fine, but the fact is, the point is, in other words, that from then on she had no children. So she may well have had children before that. The point of mentioning this Shakla Michal Matarpisa is because otherwise, without Rav mentioning that point, without Rabbi Yehuda, or Rabbi Yosef, mentioning that point, you might think the pasuk is describing Bechlal what happened to her. Now we're saying that no, as a punishment for the way she acted now, she didn't have children anymore. So you can't say that she only had a child when she first died, on the day she died. Means up until that point, she was bearing children. Now, from then on, she didn't ad yom moisa. So in other words, yes, the child Yisroam, who was born in Hebron, which was years earlier, yes, when we say that his mother was Egla, Egla is none other than Michal, and yes, she had a child then, she had children later on for years to come, until David came to Yerushalayim and brought the Oren over there, and this story happened, and then from then on, until she passed away, she never had children again, except we're saying that on the day she passed away, she did. So therefore, so the fact that it mentions Egla as a wife of David, who had a child, doesn't contradict this.
So yes, his Gemara where Shaul took her and gave her to this other guy. She took her after having children and being officially so married.
No. That was, we're talking about that she had this child for David and Hebron. That was after David became king over Shevet Yehuda.
Right, but we learned that.
No, I know. I understand what you're asking. The answer is that no, that whole story with Shaul taking her and giving her in marriage to Palti ben Laish, that was before David. That was after David had been anointed, but before David ever actually became a king. In fact, he's still on the run from Shaul during that time. Later on, after Shaul was killed in battle, and David is ruling from Hebron over Shevet Yehuda, eventually he tells Ish-bosheth, "I want Michal back," and that was the whole thing that we had yesterday. And then from then after that, so now David and Michal are able to fully be husband and wife, and then she had a child, Yisrael. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
So the question is, so we said before that David had six wives, and then later on, and therefore Nosson is telling him you could multiply that twice over. The pasuk says that David took other pilagshim, and which we're going to explain in a second what pilagshim are, and wives in Yerushalayim. So it sounds, and that pasuk is written before the story with Nosson. So the answer is Lamalo Yishmaina also. That's what it means. He took more wives in Pelagshim in order to fill up the number 18. But nevertheless, when Nosson is telling him, Kahena v'Kahena, so again, one way of looking at it is that Nosson is saying, one way of looking at it is the Pesukim are written out of order, and Vayikach David, Oid Pelagshim, and Nosson Yerushalayim is the same generically over the 30-odd years of his rule in Yerushalayim. Eventually he married more Pelagshim and more wives, but not that at the time of Bathsheba he had more of them, or you could say he did, but it means that the Navi is referring to the six that you had originally. My noshim or my pilagshim, what is the actual difference between wives and pilagshim? Amar of Yehuda Amar Rav, noshim deksuba uvekidushin, pilagshim below ksuba uvelay kidushin. Wives means they're fully married. There's a ksuba and there's kidushin. Pilagshim is that he takes them as common law wives below ksuba uvelay kidushin. There's no ksuba, no kidushin. They're just it's agreed that she's going to be exclusive to him. There was an opinion among Rishonim, Rashi brings it on Chumash, that different gears say in the Gemara over here, that Pilagshim also, there is Kiddushin, but there's no Ksuba. So according to that, in either case, there would be Kiddushin, and then just in one case, there would be without Ksuba. There's a lot of discussion about that, and about the details, and Bechlal, the Rambam holds that a commoner is not even allowed to have a pilegesh, only a king is allowed to, and the Ravid disagrees with that, and there's a lot of discussion about the ins and outs of that. There is, on top of that, when we say the king is limited to 18, does the 18 include pilagshim or not? The Rambam holds yes. The Rambam holds the total of 18 includes both wives and pilagshim. The Ravid disagrees with that, and says no, pilagshim are not counted in the total. In fact, mefoshim bring that there's a pasuk in Divrei Hayomim referring to Rechavam, the son of Shlomo, the grandson of David, where it says he had 18 wives and 60 pilagshim. So according to the David, it works out nicely. The pilagshim, he can have as many as he wants. According to the Rambam, that the maximum is 18 between wives and pilagshim. Then how is he going to understand that pasuk? So you would have to say that Rechavam was over on this mitzvah. We know that Rechavam wasn't such a great guy anyway, but there are different answers about that, and the Migdal Oriz and the Rambam even says that the correct Gusa in the Rambam would also be like the way that Ivan holds, that the Pelagshim are not counted towards the total. But there is discussion back and forth on that point. The Gemara continues, Omer of Yehuda Omer Rav, Arba Meis Yulodim Hoyuloi LeDavid. David had 400 sons. What do we mean by that? We'll explain in a second. V'cholin b'nei Yifas Toyar hoyu. All of them were born from a Yifas Toyar, because we know the Torah says that a Jewish soldier in war is allowed to take a Yifas Toyar, and we'll talk about soon the status of that child. U'megadli Bluris hoyu, and they all grew their hair long in a goyish style. V'cholin yoshim b'kurnis shel zahav. They would all sit in golden chariots. U'mahalchin b'roshe gayosas hoyu, and they would travel at the head in front of David's army. V'heim hoyu balei agrupin shel beis David. They were the mighty men. They were the muscle of beis David, because his enemies would be afraid of them. So in other words, the Gemara said, the Gemara elsewhere, in Kedushin explained, they didn't actually go to war, but they would be there in order to frighten the Goyim. So one idea being, because they're the sons of Yefos Toyar, therefore they had a Goyish look to them, and especially since they grew their hair in the Goyish style, so that would make the Goyim realize, hey, wait a minute, you know, previous enemies of David were defeated by him, and their wives were, and their women were captured, so now, do we really want to fight against him, and risk the same kind of thing, so therefore they're more likely to make peace. When we say that they were David's children, so does it mean literally they were David's? So I think Rashi mentions elsewhere that no, it doesn't mean David's own. It means from Jewish soldiers in his army. Each soldier would have a Yefas Toya. And the point would be, in other words, that so the Yad Ramah points out that it could be that it means, in other words, that there were 400 times he went to war, maybe 200 times, maybe each of them had twins, whatever, and each time he took a Yefas Toya. But then there are other Mefoshim who explain that it means that that his soldiers, it doesn't mean they were David's children. It just means David had them enrolled in his army. The fact that they're wearing their hair in Goyish style, again, as we're saying over here, is to frighten the Goyim. There is also the point, as we're going to go on to say over here in the Sugya, that the child of a Yefas Toya from the first Bia is not necessarily considered a Jew. So therefore, because after all, even though his mother was Megayah afterwards, he was already conceived when his mother was a Goyitah. So therefore, they wouldn't even be allowed to wear their hair in that Goyish style, and they're not actually considered Jews. Reb Reuven Margolius has a very interesting idea that in Divrei Yomim, after it mentions the six sons that David had in Hebron before, it mentions later on another nine sons of David. And it doesn't mention a mother's name with them. So he says maybe over here it was supposed to say Tisha Yeladim, which means nine, and then somebody abbreviated the word Tisha to a Tuf, and then somebody else thought that Tuf means 400. Anyway. So these are more children of whether they're David's own or whether they're of his soldiers who were involved in his battles. Va'amar of Yehuda Amar Rav, Tomer bas Yefas Toya Hoysa. So now Rabbi Yehuda also tells us in the name of Rav, Tomer, who was the daughter of David, was actually a daughter of Yefas Toya. So the story is as follows. We talked about before when we had the list of David's eldest children. His oldest was Amnon. So now, what happened is, later on, in Shmuel Beis, it describes that Amnon started having a taiva for his sister Tamar. So to make a long story short, he has her brought to his house, he has her come to his house under an excuse. He claims that he's sick and he needs her to cook food for him, and then while she's there, he grabs her and rapes her. Then the pasuk goes on to say that later on Avshalom, who was her brother, as we said before, Avshalom was the son of Macha. This Macha was Yefas Toya. So Avshalom was very angry about the whole thing, and 2 years later he took his opportunity and assassinated Amnon. Anyway. So it's a long, sad story over there. But anyway, so Rabbi Yehuda is telling us in the name of Rav, Tamar was actually the daughter of Yefas Toya. Her mother Macha was Yefas Toya, who had been captured in battle. Shenemar, because we have in the psukim there, when Tamar is trying to talk Amnon out of doing what he's about to do, she says, you don't need to do this. Va'ata daber no alamelech, or elamelech, it says in the pasuk, ki lo yimna eni mimecha. She says, you want to have relations with me, fine, don't do it in a way of isu like this to rape me. Speak to the king, he won't prevent me from marrying you. Now, if she's David's daughter from a regular Jewish wife, fine, they're from different mothers, they still have the same father, she'd be an heir to him. So if she's saying that the king would allow it, then it must mean that she's not considered halachically Jewish. So if she was born from a marriage of David, then a sister is not mutter to him. Whether a half sister, whether from the father's or the mother's side, is still osur in the Torah. Therefore, you see that she was a daughter of Yefas Toya. Now, Tosfos points out like this. When we say that a Jewish soldier is allowed to have relations with Yefas Toya the first time, does that mean before she converts or only afterwards? So Tosfos discusses over here, Rashi and Kedushin seems to imply that only after that she's gone through the whole process of Geirus, the whole process that it describes there at the beginning of Parshas Kiseitse, only then is the Jewish soldier allowed to have relations with her. Well, in that case, Tosfos says, how does that help us over here? Fine, Macha is a Yefas Toya. But according to that way of understanding it, it means that Tomer couldn't have been conceived until after her mother was a Giyoris, and in that case she's Amnon's sister or half sister, and she's still also to him. So Tosfos prefers the explanation to say that it means that the Jewish soldier is allowed to have relations with her when she's a Goita. And then afterwards, if he wants to keep her as a wife, then you have the whole procedure that it describes there in Parshas Kisetze. So in that case, then fine. Tamar was conceived when her mother was still a goita, and therefore now, even though she's a geyoras, she's still, even though her mother became a geyoras, and even though she was born already to a Jewish mother, then she's still mutter to Amnon. The other way of understanding it, Tosfos says, according to Rashi's way of understanding it, you would have to say that when Macha was captured in battle, she was already pregnant. In other words, she had been married or had znus or whatever, it doesn't really matter. For our purposes, she was pregnant, then she was captured in battle, and then David married her as one of his wives. But nevertheless, we're still saying she wasn't a biological daughter of David at all, but because she was raised in the palace from when she was born, then she's called a daughter of David, even though she's not actually. So two different ways of looking at it. The Rambam paskins like Tosfos' preferred explanation that the Jewish soldier is allowed to have relations with her the one time while she's a goita, and therefore that explains then Tamar was conceived from that, and therefore she would have been mutter to Amnon.
Even if it's the same father.
So that's the thing. Even though, according to that way of looking at it, she is David's biological daughter, but because she was conceived when her mother was a goita, therefore she's not considered related lahalacha to David at all, yeah. Okay, so the Gemara takes time over here to darshan a couple of the psukim in that story. The pasuk says that Amnon is feeling that he has a taiva for Tamar and he doesn't know what to do about it. So the pasuk says, "Lo Amnon Reya." Amnon had a friend, Shmo Yonadav ben Shima Achi David. The friend's name was Yonadav, the son of Shima, the brother of David. So in other words, this Yonadav was a cousin of Avshalom's. He's a nephew of David's. V'hoya ish chacham v'yonasan ben v'yonav. And the pasuk says that v'yonadav ish chacham v'goymer. He was a smart man. So what do you mean smart? And he's the one who gives Amnon the idea to pretend that he's sick and invite Tamar to his house and so forth. So what does it mean chacham? Amnon v'yonadav ish chacham l'risha. Means he was a chacham for wickedness. Usually a chacham means someone who uses this chachma for good. But here, unfortunately, this Yonadav used this chachma for an evil purpose to get to show Amnon how he could accomplish his taiva. With that said, the Malbim on the Pasuk mitigates what Yonadav does a little bit. He figures maybe it'll be enough for Amnon to see Tamar and then that'll cool down his Yetzirah. But if so, then that backfired. But you don't give in to the Yetzirah and then figure that'll help. But anyway, yeah. The pasuk continues. By Yoimer, this friend Yonadav says, "Madua atakocha dal ben Amelech? Why you ben Amelech, son of the king? Why you're looking so thin?" And Amnon tells him, "Because I'm in love with Tamar." And by Yoimer, Yonadav shchav amutchokha v'hischa v'gamer. So Yonadav tells him, "Lie in bed, pretend to be sick, and when your father comes to visit, tell him that you want Tamar to come make you some food." And tell your father that he wants Tamar to come and prepare you some food. And so the pasuk describes she came and she made him levivos, which are like kreplach or something like that. She took the pan and she poured out the food in front of him. What kind of food did she make him? She made him something fried. Now, what's the point of that? Why is that important to know? Ben Yehoyada explains, because that was all part of the plot. If Amnon had asked for food that's cooked in a pot, then David would have been suspicious. Wait, why do you need her to come to your house to make that? Let her make that in her part of the palace, and then she can bring it over to you in a covered pot. But here, where it's fried in a pan, in an open pan, and it would lose its heat quickly, then David figured, you know what, it's reasonable enough. She should have to prepare it in Amnon's quarters, because otherwise it'll get cold by the time she brings it in. Okay, so the pasuk goes on to describe what happened. He grabs a hold of her and then rapes her. Then the pasuk says, "Vayisna eha Amnon sina gdola ma'od." Amnon hated her with a tremendous hatred. My timer, what changed all of a sudden? Why did he all of a sudden hate her? Now, of course, psychologically, you could say because he blamed him, he figured he realized now what a wrong thing he had done, and he transferred it to her, etc. But the Gemara wants to find like a more practical, down to earth reason. A hair from her Eva got tied onto his Eva and made him a Khrushchevka, cut off the tip of his Eva, which actually would make it. He would be Osir from then on to marry a regular Jewish woman, but also it's a tremendous blow to him. So he must say, okay, he's saying it got tied accidentally. She didn't do anything to him. Why would that cause him to hate her with such a tremendous passion? Ella, rather, it's not that it got tied accidentally, she tied it. As he's doing this to her, she used the hair over there to cause him to wound him and make him a krus shofcha. So now he has now he hates her for that. So the Gemara asks, Amy, is that so? How does she have hair there, b'chlal? V'hadarash Rava, didn't Rava darshan, my dichtiv, what does it mean, a pasuk, v'yetzi lach shem v'goyim v'yofich, the Navi Yechezkel describes the Jewish people, you had a reputation among the nations for your beauty, means she'en lehem l'gnais Yisrael, le'seya b'esa shechi, v'le'beisa erva. Jewish women, at that time, before Churban Bayis tradition, did not have hair in under the arm or in the area of the erva. So how does she have enough hair to be able to do this kind of thing? Now Rashi brings that later on after the Churban, then Yeshaya gives a nevuah that it was a result of the averus of the Jewish people. Then they're going to end up growing a lot of hair in these places, and it's not as nice. But back then they didn't have that. And the answer is, now, the Marshal is bothered by, we have Shtei Cyrus in Halacha, that are the symbol of, that are the simon of when a woman reaches puberty, so how does all that work if there's no hair? So Marshal says it means they had hair, but a very fine amount of it, not enough that you would have this kind of thing, except in the case of Tomer, as the Gemara is going to explain now. Marshal says you don't really need that, all you need is, we're saying the Jewish women would shave it. Fine, they would grow hair, but they would shave it, as opposed to the question is, why Tomer didn't? And the answer is, Shiny Tomer de Basti Fastoya Avoy, the answer is Tomer, the daughter of Fastoya, so she doesn't have the genetics of born Jews, and therefore she had hair over there, and therefore all of this could develop. Ben Yehoyada even says that the hair may have been particularly strong and spiky, such that it would have the ability to actually cause this wound to him of Khrushchevka. The pasuk continues, Vatikach Tomer Efer Al Rosha. Tomer took ashes and put it on her head as a sign of mourning to what had happened to her. Ksonas, it says in the pasuk, a pasim asher lo kara, and she ripped the ksonas pasim that she was wearing. And she's going. The pasuk continues. She's screaming out about what had happened to her. So what Tana Mishmeder Bishrab and Korcha Gedr Godr Godra Toma Ba'isa Shah. With that action, Toma made a tremendous fence around the Torah. So it wasn't just that she's a poor girl. Look what happened to her. She got raped, and now she's just venting her anger, her upset and her hurt in public. She was actually accomplishing something with that. People said to themselves, "Libnois malachim kach." If such a thing happened to a princess, libnois had yotes alachas kama v'kama. How much more so that regular girls are in danger of such a thing? Im tznuis kach. If for a tzniustik girl, the pasuk mentions at the beginning. At the beginning of the story, it says Amnon didn't know what to do, or how he's going to accomplish his taiva with her, because the point is because she was very sneering, so she never was around the boys. So how is he going to have the chance until his cousin Yonadav came up with this idea? So if she was a sneeristic girl, and look what happened to her, Lepritzis, Allah has kama kama, how much more so other girls who are not so careful to begin with such things. So the result was, Amar of Yehuda Amar Rab, Ba'oysa Shog Gozu, Ala Yichud Vala Pnuya. At that point, the Chachamim made a gzera, David's Beistin made a gzera about Yichud to not be in Yichud with an Eshes Ish, and about Pnuya to not have relations with an unmarried girl. Like Gemara says, wait a minute, what do you mean? Yichud daraisa. To not have yichud with a woman who's also to you is also daraisa. So David's based in, there's nothing to make a takana about that. Where is there a hint in the Torah about that yichud is osur with a woman that you're osur to marry? Shenemar, you have when it comes to a mesis, the pasuk describes how you may have a person. You may have a person who tries to convince you to worship Avodah Zarah, and it may even be a close relative of yours, and you have to bring them to Beis Din and have them executed. the pasuk says, "Ki yisischa achicha ven imecha." If your brother, the son of your mother, tries to convince you to worship avodah zarah, what do you mean? This is the son of your mother. The chi ben a mesis ben av ein mesis. Do you think that only a son of the same mother would try to be mesis, but a son of the father, the same father, would not? Ela loy malach. So the pasuk is hinting to you, ben misyached imimai means a son would be allowed to be in yichud with his mother. His mother is an erva to him, of course, but nevertheless, a normal person doesn't have a taiva for his mother or mother for his son, and therefore they're allowed to be in yichud together. So by mentioning ben imecha hints at that point. But you're not allowed to be in Yichud with any of the other arayas in the Torah, which includes an HSH, includes other close relatives, etc. So you don't need David's based in a few hundred years after the Torah is given to make a gzera about that. So you're right. Ela ema gazru al yichud dipnuya. What it means is David's based in made a gzera that you should not be in yichud with an unmarried girl. Until then, it was only also with arayas, but an unmarried girl. After all, there may be at most there's an isulav having relations with her outside of marriage, according to the Rambam, according to the Ravid, maybe not even that. But now, as a result of what happened with Tamar, they made that gzera. In other words, had that gzera been in effect in the time, then Tamar never would have gone over to Amnon's house, at least not without a chaperone, and the whole thing wouldn't have happened. So that's the thing. We're saying that when Tamar was crying and screaming over there, it wasn't just that she's venting about what happened to her. She actually accomplished something tremendous for Jewish women in future generations. Now, the pasuk goes on to, so now, we mentioned before the older children of David. So far we just talked about Amnon. Kilov doesn't mention much about in the pasukim what happened to him, Yeshayim, that he passed away young. The next one after him is Avshalom, and we know a lot about him from the pasukim. And the next one after him is Adoniah. So now let's talk about him. The pasuk is Vadoniah ben Chagas misnase lemer ani emlech. At the beginning of Sefer Melachim, it's an achtora of Chayesara. Adoniah ben Chagas is raising himself up to say, "I will be king." So what does that mean, raising himself up? How is he trying to be king? This teaches us that he tried to fit David's crown to his head, but it wouldn't fit. Namely, Rashi explains that David's crown had a special shape to it. It had a bar running from the front of the crown to the back. So a normal person wouldn't be able to wear it. The bar would get in the way. Only if a person had a crevice in his head that would exactly fit, that the bar would exactly fit into, then it would fit him. So it was actually a simon. If a person had, if the heir apparent has that kind of crevice in his head, then he would be able to fit the crown on his head, and if not, then not. So Adoniah is trying to make it fit, but it wouldn't fit. That's how Misnase, he's like raising himself up to say, "Ani emloch, I'm going to be king," but he's seeing that it doesn't actually fit him. Now, the pasuk continues about Adoniah. Vayas lo rechav ufarashim. It says he made for himself a chariot and horsemen. Vachamishim ish rotsim lefonav. And 50 men running in front of him. So it wasn't a mayravosa. What's the big deal? He's a prince. Fine, he's not the crown prince, maybe, but he's still a prince. He's entitled to have a retinue like that. What's so special about it? And the answer is, Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav, kulam netulei these 50 men were not stam. What they did is, with each one of them, they gave them some kind of potion that dissolved their spleen. The spleen is an internal organ. It recycles red blood cells, basically. But it's also, it's not necessary for a person to live. It's not a vital organ. So like this, and when a person has it within him, it makes him heavier. If he doesn't have it, then he's lighter. So Adoniah wants these people to be able to run as fast as possible. So he had them all undergo this kind of thing to remove their spleen. Now, to actually do it with an operation might be dangerous, but in this case, he has them drink some kind of potion that causes it to dissolve. And he also had the soles of their feet scooped out, so this way they could run anywhere he wants to go, even over thorns or things like that, and not hurt their feet. So in other words, when it says vayas, he made for himself, meaning that he made that these men should be in this condition so that they can run in front of him as fast as possible. And so therefore, that's the pasuk highlights that. Maybe the point is to show what an achzer he was. Maybe whatever it is, the point is that he's trying to make himself king, and then Bathsheba gets wind of it, and she tells David to right away. She and Nosson and Avi tell David to right away have Shlomo anointed as king before Adoniah has a chance to do his thing. All right, the Mishnah says, The next mitzvah of a king, lo yarbe lo susim, he's not allowed to have too many horses. So what does that mean? How many can he have? Ela kedei mekavta. He can have as many as he needs for his chariot, as we'll see in the Gemara. And the pasuk continues, v'chesed v'zov lo yarbe lo moed. He's not allowed to have a lot of gold and silver. That means ela kedei litin aspania. He has to have. He can have enough to be able to pay wages to his soldiers and immediate expenses like that. It means, in particular, Rashi says that he has to pay his soldiers on an annual basis, so he's allowed to have enough money for that. And in fact, Mephoshim said that that's what it means. He can't have more in his treasury than he would need for 1 year's expenses. Next, then you have a mitzvah esef for a king. The kosev lo sefer Torah l'shmoi. Yeah, the pasuk says he has to have a sefer Torah written, and that means it has to be written l'shmoi. It has to be written for his name. Yotzel mochama mitzia imo. When the king goes out to war, he brings that sefer Torah with him. Nichnas hu machnisa imo. When he comes back, he brings it back with him. Yoshev v'din hi imo. When he sits in judgment, when he sits as a member of a beis din, as we talked about at the beginning of the perek, that a king from Malchus beis David is allowed to sit on a beis din. He emo, then he has that sefer Torah with him. Mesiv, and when he's reclining to eat, he connecto, he has it in front of him. So it's his constant companion. Shnema, as the pasuk says, the sefer Torah should be with him, and he should read with it, and he should read from it his entire life. So the Gemara says, Tana Rabbana, when it says lo yarbe lo susim, when it says you should not have many horses, if you only had, if the pasuk only says it that way, then you would think it means you can't even have enough for a chariot and for horsemen. Tamud loy, no, the pasuk says lo yarbe lo susim. And that means loy, he can't increase just for himself in order to make himself look big. Look, I have a lot of horses. But he can have enough for his chariot and for his horsemen. He has to have a cavalry in his army. Susim. So in that case, why does the pasuk say susim in the plural means susim abatlonin? He can't have any horses that are just idle over there and are just there for show. So any horses that he has to be for practical use. So the Gemara says, and the point is, because the pasuk says, lo yarbe lo susim, and it says he shouldn't bring the people back to Mitzrayim, l'man harbo sus, that he shouldn't increase horses. So first it says susim, plural, and then sus. So the point is, it means, in other words, that he can't have horses that are just sitting there idle. Minayin shafilu sus echad go bato shuv lo yarbe. How do we know that even one single horse that's there just for show and it's not actually being used, that he's already over on this mitzvah of lo yarbe? Tamad lema l'man harbo sus. Because the pasuk says that he shouldn't increase a horse. So the Gemara says, well, if he's already over on one individual horse, susim lamali, then why does the pasuk need to say susim in the plural? And the answer is lava beloisa called sus vasus. It means it's over a separate loisa set for every individual horse that he has that's extra, that's unneeded. So, in other words, Tosfos summarizes that basically there are three things. You learn from that. If it just said lo yarbe lo sus, then you would think that he's not allowed to have horses at all. When it says lo yarbe lo susim, means that he's over on every individual horse. But then l'man harbe sus teaches us that he's over even if he has one extra horse. Okay, so the Gemara says, wait a minute. Time to cost Rahmana loy. So you're telling me because the pasuk says loy, he's allowed to have enough horses for his chariot and for his cavalry. So what, if it didn't say the word loy in the pasuk, would you think that he can't have a chariot pulled by horses and he can't have a horseman in his army at all? He's not much of a king without those kinds of things. And the answer is loy tzricha la pushi. The point is, of the word loy, is he is allowed to have extra. La'apushi means he's allowed to have many, many chariots and many horses. He just can't have, so in other words, like this, he doesn't just have to have the bare minimum number of horses to pull his chariot. He can have more. And the same thing with his cavalry, with his horsemen and his army. He doesn't just need the bare minimum. He's allowed to have a larger number of horsemen. But he can't just have horses that are there just bottle and just there for show. So Rashi gives a second girsa, not la'apushi, but la'apuchi with a ches, which means, sometimes you're riding on a horse. Eventually, the horse is going to get tired. So you take along, to begin with, a spare so that you can change horses after a while. That kind of thing is also mutter, because that second horse is not levatola. He's not just there for show. He's there for a practical reason, so you can switch to him when the first one gets tired. So that, we learn from the word loy, is fine for him to do. Next, it says in the Mishnah, the Chesef Hazov La Yavala El Kedilit in Aspanya, he can't have more gold and silver than necessary, only enough to pay his soldiers. So the Braisa goes through, the Gemara goes through a similar Braisa. Tomer Rabban, the Chesef Hazov La Yavaloi, when it says he shouldn't have a lot of gold and silver, Yochel Afil Kedilit in Aspanya, you would think maybe he can't even have enough for that pay. Tomer Lama Loi, and again the Pasuk says, La Yavaloi, Loi, Ein Amarbi, he can't increase it just for himself to show off his wealth. But he can't have enough to pay the wages of his soldiers. So again, the Gemara says, time to cost of Rahman Aloy. So what? Only because it says Loy, does he have a heter for that? And you're telling me if it didn't say the word Loy in the Pasuk, he wouldn't even be allowed enough to keep enough of a reserve to pay his soldiers? How is he supposed to run an army then? And the answer is, again, that he's allowed to have to pay them a generous amount. He's allowed to have enough in order to pay them bonuses and things like that. But he doesn't have to just do the bare minimum that he would have to pay, but he can't just have gold and silver there. That's just for the purpose of showing off. Well, the Gemara says, Hashtad Amat Loy L'Drosha. So now we're saying by the horses and by the gold and silver, the word Loy is meant for a Drosha, respectively, that he can have extra horses in order to swap in the middle or in order to have a larger army or whatever. And the same thing with the gold and silver. Lo Yabel Loy Noshin My Daushes Bay. Then what are you doing with the word Loy in Lo Yabel Loy Noshin? And the answer is, Lamo'ote Hebiotis, that comes to tell us it's a mute. A king is limited to a maximum number of wives, 18, as we learned on Amud Aleph. But a Hediot is allowed to have as many as he wants. Now, practically speaking, the Gemara mentions elsewhere, the Chachamim advised that a regular person should not have more than four wives, because that way at least each of them will get Oino with him once a month. But in principle, a Hediot could marry as many as he wants, only a king is limited to the 18, as we said in the Pasuk. Okay. Fine, so we'll continue tomorrow, Bastishem.